She said, "Well, you mean you got to watch the show?" He said, "Well, I'm going to get this new whisk." She said, "A new whisk? You have thousands of whisks. You do not need another whisk. That is totally unnecessary. No, you do not need a new whisk." He said, "No, I'm going to wait and get my whisk." And so he did. Sure enough, watched the show. And at the end of the show, he passed out the free whisk. Well, you know those little prizes that you get watching those shows. They're real cheap. So he's so excited about it, though. It's a new whisk. It's a different color than he's got. And so he's walking out. He opens the thing. And one of the wires pops up and hits him in the eye. Well, it causes him to trip over the curb into the road and gets hit by a truck. And the moral of the story is don't take unnecessary whisk. That's the moral of the story. I know it's pretty bad, isn't it? But hopefully it will help you guys. All right, glad everybody is here. I'm going to read to you something that was posted in the Cobb County School Districts, there in Georgia, the front of the biology textbooks. The school board got together and decided they felt like there needed to be this sticker in the front of the biology textbooks, and so you can read it there. This is an exact replica of the sticker. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Now, would you like to suggest to any person, if you were to tell them what you believe about creation, would you say to them, though, "I want you to look at this for yourself. I want you to study it carefully. I want you to critically analyze it from every side, every angle. I want you to look at it with an open mind, and let's see if the evidence really does prove this." What I would like to say is that if you hold an idea, you hold a belief, that you hold a thought, that you couldn't encourage somebody to look at with an open mind and study it carefully and critically consider it, then you need to question why you hold that particular thought or belief. In fact, the Apostle Paul said it well when he said, "Test all things. Hold fast to what's good." What did he mean? Look at everything with an open mind. Study everything carefully. Critically consider it all. You know, ironically, what is said lots of times is that people who believe in God or people who are religious, well, they have closed minds. They do not want to look at stuff with an open mind. They do not want to critically consider stuff. They want to study it carefully. They just want to take whatever their preacher gives them. And so religious ideas where people don't look at stuff closely, that's the only reason you believe in the idea of a God. That's what lots of people would say. Now, nothing could be further from the truth. In many instances, unfortunately, some people do hold their belief in God without having ever rigorously challenged it. And so when someone says, "Why do you believe?" they just say, "Oh, my mom did, and I do too." Well, that's a bad defense of the belief. But everybody should be willing to say, "Yeah, I don't have a belief that you can't look at with an open mind, study it carefully, and critically consider." Now, this particular sticker did not stay in the textbooks there in Cobb County, Georgia in 2002. In fact, an organization sued the school district because of this sticker and forced them to remove it because they said this sticker is unconstitutional. They said it was unconstitutional because, maybe you'll remember the case, I don't know if you will, they said it violated the separation of church and state. Okay, let's look back at that. And let's see where the violation of the separation of church and state is, if you don't mind. Show me one place in this sticker that talks about God, Jesus, the Bible, creation, anything remotely touching the theme of a creator. Well, there's nothing. All it discusses is evolution. Now, you got to be real careful with that term, evolution, because it's so often abused. It's so often misunderstood, and many times it's intentionally so. And here's what I mean by that. If you were to ask or look in a dictionary for the definition of evolution, here's what you'll find: change over time. Okay, so if that's one definition of evolution, do things change over time? Oh, absolutely, positively. You know, I've got less hair on the top of my head than I had in the past. You know why? Because I'm evolving. I'm changing over time. One very loose definition of evolution, but what is often presented as the definition of evolution is change over time. Do things change over time? Absolute positivity. But the other definition of evolution is the addition of new genetic information that can take a single-celled amoeba from that state to a human over multiplied millions of years. And what is that called? Evolution. So when someone says, does evolution occur? And you say, no. They say, you mean things don't change over time? You say, well, then, yeah, things do change over time. Okay, so you're saying evolution is true? Well, yeah, okay, so humans evolved from primates. What that? You see the problem? It's something called equivocation. Equivocation is when you take one definition and you get someone to agree on that, and then you put in another definition for the same word and use it to manipulate the discussion. Let me show you what I mean. If I were to say, what am I holding in my hand right now? Nothing. Okay, I don't have anything in my hand. I'm holding nothing. God is all powerful. What is stronger than God? Nothing is stronger than God. So what I'm holding in my hand is stronger than God. Well, you know there's something fishy there. You know that doesn't quite work. Okay, I'm not holding anything. I'm holding nothing in my hand. Nothing stronger than God. And so what I'm holding in my hand is stronger. Okay, you know something's not right, but it's just hard to put your finger on. So as we go through this discussion, what you need to understand is that when these people are talking about evolution being a theory, not a fact, they're not saying things don't change over time. They're not saying change over time is a theory. They're saying the idea that you can add genetic information to a single-celled organism and get it to a human over multiplied millions of years, that is something that has never been proven, and you should look at any information that presents that idea with an open mind, study it carefully and critically consider it. Now, what I'm going to show you is that when that happens, you start to see that the things that have been used to prove evolution, from goo to you evolution, we'll call it, the things that have been used to prove that, well, if you look at them real carefully and you study them real critically, let's see what happens. Law of biogenesis is very simple to understand. It says that in nature, things reproduce after their own kind, that every living organism came from a previously existing organism of its own kind in nature. It's really easy to understand. You guys recognize it. You use this law of biogenesis all the time. Unfortunately, in the past, it wasn't well known. In fact, in the past, things they thought spontaneously generated from non-living chemicals and could turn into life. If you were to ask people, hey, what happens if you take a T-bone steak, smack it on the kitchen counter in the middle of the summer, and leave your window open? What spontaneously generates on that T-bone steak? Maggots. They just pop into existence from the chemical processes of the air on the steak. You didn't see any maggots crawl onto the steak. You didn't see any maggots fall out of the sky onto the steak. But somehow you've got maggots on the steak. How'd they get there? Well, sometimes life pops into existence from non-living chemicals. It's just what happens. They said, you want some more proof? If you'll take a log and you put it in a ditch somewhere with a bunch of water in it, leave it there for 2 or 3 months and pull the bark off of it, what will you see? Bugs and beetles and grubs have spontaneously generated underneath the bark of that log. That's proof that sometimes life spontaneously generates. In fact, they said if you take old sweaty rags and you wrap them in some wheat and stick them in the corner of your barn and leave them there for a month or two, guess what's going to happen? What do old sweaty rags and the fermenting process of wheat produce in the floorboard, in the floorboards of your barn? Mice and rats. They just spontaneously generate from the chemical processes in wheat and rags. Now that is humorous to us because we think, no, that's not how that happens. And we know that's not how it happens. But they didn't know that in 1668 when a man decided he was going to do an experiment to validate this spontaneous generation or to invalidate it. There's a man by the name of Francisco Reedy. Some people pronounce his name Reddy, R-E-D-I. Came up with a very simple experiment. It's one you'll see in virtually every biology textbook you ever read. Put a bunch of meat in the bottom of jars, left them unsealed, put a bunch of meat in the bottom of jars, hermetically airtight, sealed them with something like plastic wrap so nothing could get into them, watched and saw what happened. Flies landed on the unsealed meat, maggots. Flies tried to get in the sealed meat, couldn't, nothing. He said, you know what? I think flies are producing maggots. They said, no. He said, your problem is you didn't let air get in there. Air is a key ingredient to spontaneous generation. He said, okay, well, let's fix my experiment a little bit. So put meat in the bottom of jars unsealed, meat in the bottom of jars sealed, and then in the middle he had some jars that had meat in it with a gauze-type netting substance on the top. Flies landed on the meat that was unsealed, maggots. They tried to get in the sealed, nothing. They landed on the gauze netting-type substance. Maggots formed in the netting, but they didn't form on the meat. He said, I believe flies are producing maggots. They said, well, we think you're right. So do you think spontaneous generation doesn't happen? He said, no, I just don't think maggots spontaneously generate. He said, I think other stuff still does. And for another 200 years, people still continue to believe that life just pops into existence from non-living chemicals until a man by the name of Louis Pasteur came along and dealt the death blow to spontaneous generation. Now, here's what Pasteur did. Very simple experiment. He took some meat broth, boiled it, put it in special flask with long S-shaped curved necks so that air could go back into the meat, but any microscopic organisms would get caught in the bottom of the S-shaped curve. Boiled the meat, let it sit there for a day, nothing. Let it sit there for a week, nothing. Some of them, if I understand right, he let sit for a year. Some of them even maybe 10 years. I haven't been able to find exactly where, but some of them, they said, went for years and years and years. They microscoped in on them in 1886 or so, 1868 or so, nothing. Then he would break the neck off of that flask. The air would go straight back into it. Tiny microscopic organisms would be there coming from the air. Since 1868, no one in the history of biology would ever suggest life spontaneously generates from non-living chemicals. It's a scientifically disproven idea. Let me try to nail this down. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. Every single biological experiment ever done proves the law of biogenesis. And that law, which has never seen a single exception, says that in nature, life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. Now, what you're told in textbooks about evolution is that some 4.8 billion years ago, there was a chemical soup of non-living chemicals like ammonia and hydrogen, etc. And something struck those and formed the first building blocks of life, and those building blocks somehow got together spontaneously and formed the first single cell. What I find so very ironic is that in one sentence, the biology textbooks will tell you, and Reedy and Spallanzi and Pasteur proved once and for all that the law of biogenesis is true, that life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. But in the past, that had to be different because we've got life now. Naturally speaking, you cannot get life from non-living chemicals. So as you're looking at this idea, the first challenge to the atheistic, non-supernatural advent of life is that you can't get life from non-living chemicals, and if you're going to take an atheistic, materialistic view, you have to be able to do that. But the second challenge is, okay, number one, the law of biogenesis says comes from previously existing life, but the second challenge is, of its own kind. Now, let me explain to you what that means. Now, several years ago, I was little. We were moving from East Tennessee to Middle Tennessee, and we had a dog named Max. And Max was just getting fatter and fatter, and Max was going with us from East Tennessee to Middle Tennessee. And on the trip, we had put Max in the floorboard of the U-Haul, and we moved her into the bathtub of the hotel room. I'm sure we did not tell the people at the hotel what we were doing, but the next morning we woke up and looked into the bathtub, and lo and behold, there were 8 of the most beautiful baby hippopotamuses you have ever, ever seen in your life. My dog gave birth to 8 baby hippopotamuses, and we sold those. I went to Fried Hardeman University, and that's why I was able to afford my education. Do you believe that? No, you don't believe that. Why? Well, because you were there. Well, no, you weren't there. Why don't you believe my dog gave birth to 8 hippopotamuses? Well, because dogs don't give birth to hippopotamuses, do they? What do they give birth to? You mean to tell me you've seen every dog in the world give birth and you know they only give birth to puppies? But you haven't. I haven't either. But there's the law of biogenesis that constrains the birth of any animal to an animal of its own kind. Now, here's what you can get from the dog kind. You can take something like two gray wolves, and from the genetic information that they've got in their genome, you can breed out a Saint Bernard or a teacup Chihuahua from the genetic information in two dogs similar to the gray wolf kind. But you can't breed out a lizard. You can't breed out a lion. You can't breed out a horse kind. You can get a Chihuahua that could never get back together with a Saint Bernard. You could breed a teacup poodle that could never get back with a Great Dane. But you could get every single species of dog we got from two gray wolf-like dogs that had a genome that had that much information. You just would need to, okay, when this pair of dogs has a litter, pick the littlest one. When that dog has a litter, pick the littlest one. When that dog has a litter, pick the littlest one. Now, here's what happens. You get down to, let's say a Dachshund. You've probably seen those, dogs, Dachshunds. They got the long bodies, look kind of like a little hot dog. You know what the problem with Dachshunds is? I don't know if you've ever had one. The problem with Dachshund is they get so fat, they love to eat so much, and they get so fat, that their hips give out because genetically they're not very robust. You know why? Because as you get down to a teacup poodle and as you go all the way up to a Saint Bernard, you aren't adding genetic information. You're isolating genetic information, and this teacup poodle does not have as much as that original pair of gray wolf-type dogs. You didn't gain information. You didn't somehow make a new kind. You just basically bred it out to have less and less genetic information. Now, as you look at this law of biogenesis, what you have to have is not only life cannot come from non-living chemicals, but it always multiplies after its own kind. What if I were to say, yeah, of course, my dog didn't have eight hippopotamuses. It had eight half birds, half lizards. We called them bizzards. They were awesome. They were, okay, all right, no, okay. 90% dog, 10% birds. We called them, I don't know what, and they had a little feather right on the top of their head. Did you buy that? No. Why? Dogs give birth to puppies. Cats give birth to kittens. Now, that is the law of biogenesis. Now, here's what you had to have if evolution were true. Not only do you have to have non-living chemicals give rise to the first life, but then you have to have that life evolve into multicellular bacteria. And then that bacteria evolve into, you have to have life produce something other than its own kind, not once, not twice, not 20 times or 1,000 times. You got to have that happen millions and millions of times. And when you ask the scientific community, could you just show me it happened once? There's never been an example of it. That's why it's the law of biogenesis. Now, here's what I find very interesting, the fruit fly. For 100 years, it's about 118 years now. They started this in about 1900. For 100 years, they have been zapping the fruit fly with every type of mutagenic radiation that they can possibly zap it with. They have put all kinds of chemicals on it. They have zapped it with radiation beams. They've done everything they can to it. And they've gotten some interesting results. You know, they can get a fruit fly to grow wings on its legs. They can get a fruit fly to grow wings out of its antenna sections. They can get a fruit fly to grow 6 or 8 or 10 wings or no wings. They can get one to grow legs on its head or antenna on where its legs are supposed to be. They have mutated them to grow all kinds of stuff all over the place. But you know what they've never gotten done a single time in the last 100? Now, here's why fruit flies are good candidates for this. They have a new generation every 14 days. So if you were wanting to map some type of evolutionary change over time, the fruit fly would be perfect. I mean, really, they have produced the equivalent of millions of years of fruit fly mutations in the last 120 years in the lab. And you know what you still got? Always? Fruit fly. Fruit fly, every single time, never changed into anything other than a fruit fly. Well, it might have too many wings. Why? Because the genetic information for a wing is already in the genome of the fruit fly. It might have a leg where its head is. Why? Because the genetic written information for where that leg was supposed to be got jumbled up. But you didn't add or build any new genetic information to the fruit fly. It's never been done. You still got fruit flies. And so, number one, the challenge to evolution is, the main challenge is, it can't get over the law of biogenesis. I mean, you can't even get it off the ground. You can't get life from non-living chemicals, and then you can't get that life to change from some kind of life to another kind of life. That's your first challenge. But then, as you start looking at this, they say, okay, well, we've got examples of evolution in action. Now, this is the English peppered moth. It's from a general science book back in 1989. They're still using this. It's the story that before the Industrial Revolution, you see the light-colored moths and the dark-colored moths, and the population looked like this, 95% light, 5% dark. Now, the story that is spun to us is that if you were a bird and you came upon a tree trunk and you saw these two, or you did not see both of them, which one of those two would you eat? Well, yeah, the darker colored one, because you could see it, and it's not camouflaged as well. But then they said, okay, after the Industrial Revolution, the soot on the trees killed all the lichens, and the moth population changed from 95% light to 95% dark, and 5% dark to 5% light. And then we are told, notice, now, unfortunately, you have a very large tree right in the way of a word that I would like you to see. Is that a real tree? Okay, here we go. Melanism, evolution in action. Do you see that? That other tree, you might not be able to see. I don't think we'll have to do that again. Okay, here's what they call that, evolution in action. Now, let's ask this question. Is that change over time? Has the moth population changed? Yes, it changed a little bit. 95% light color to 95% dark. Okay, you do have a change. So in one sense, if they're going to try to sneak the idea of evolution in, hey, did it change over time? Yes. That's not what they mean, though. When they say evolution in action, what they mean is this is an example of evidence that will prove you can get bacteria to change into a human. That's what they mean. Now, let's ask the question, is this real evolution in action? Okay, first problem is, if this is going to prove to us that bacteria can evolve into a human over multiplied millions of years, then what you'll need is new genetic information added to an organism's genome to add stuff like a brain or a spinal cord or a backbone or something like that in the English pepper moth here. Okay, quick question. Before the Industrial Revolution, there was genetic information to form two varieties of the English pepper moth. What were they? Light and dark. After the Industrial Revolution, there was genetic information to form two varieties of English pepper moth. What were they? Light and dark. Let me give you maybe a good illustration of why this isn't evolution in action. You got a dog and it gives birth to 10 puppies, and 8 of them are light colored, 2 of them are dark colored. You got an 80 to 20% there, looking at that, of light to dark. Okay, in a tragic accident, that dog is walking across a frozen pond, the ice breaks, and 7 of the light puppies fall into the frozen water and they perish. And now you have 2 dark puppies and 1 light. What is that? According to this piece of evidence. Well, that's evolution in action. The population of the varieties has now shifted, and you just now have evolution in action. Well, no, that just doesn't make sense at all, does it? Because that's not evolution in action. You didn't get any new genetic information, which is what you've got to have to get evolution, the kind that they're talking about bacteria to a human, to turn into a human. And they don't have that. And when you start looking at that, hold on just a second. You ever taken pictures? You ever taken a picture of a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old on Easter? Maybe you haven't. I've tried it a time or two. You know how, you ever thrown a duck into the mix or a rabbit? You get a 5, 3, and 2-year-old or 1-year-old, and you throw a rabbit in the mix, and you say, okay, just sit still right here. I'm going to take a picture. Rather difficult. You ever tried to get 2 English peppered moths to land right beside each other on a tree trunk so you can get a perfect picture for a textbook? You ever tried that? No, you haven't ever tried that. Do you know why? Because, incidentally, English peppered moths don't land on tree trunks. They've been knowing that English peppered moths don't land on tree trunks, so how in the world did we get? Oh, what happened? I just escaped. Hey, go back up there to somebody back there at the just go back up there and do start slideshow from, there you go. All right, nice, hit the wrong button. Here we go. Now, question. If English pepper moths don't land on tree trunks, how'd they get the pictures? They just made them up. They made the entire idea up, and they caught the English pepper moths and glued them to the trees or pinned them to the trees, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And in the course of, I think now, 60 years or so, I believe they found maybe 2 or 4 pair of English pepper moths on tree trunks ever. And most of the English pepper moths land on the underside of leaves, and they fly at night. And so this idea that somehow a bird would better see the dark-colored one, it's just not, it's not true. Now, Bob Ritter, Canadian textbook writer, he knew the English pepper moths were fake. Here's what he said. He said, I mean, you got to look at the audience. I mean, how convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? So he's saying, I know it's not true. But the 6th graders, 8th graders, 10th graders that were trying to teach about evolution, it's just going to get too complicated if we talk about genetics and adding DNA and adding new material. We don't have time for all that. In fact, it's real convoluted. It's going to be real hard to explain. So I know this doesn't really, this is not real evidence. I know it, but it makes the point so well, we're going to keep using it. Now, are you starting to see why they might not want a sticker in the front that says, look at this with an open mind, study it carefully, and critically consider it? Because if you know, you're the textbook writer, and you know it's false, but it just makes your point so well, and so you're going to keep it. See the problem there? He says, I mean, the advantage of this example of natural selection, it's extremely visual. Let's say I got this new theory that when white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. And you say, cow, that's ridiculous. Of course they don't. And I say, well, actually, they do, and I can prove it. And so tomorrow, if you'll just come to the congregation tomorrow, I'll bring me some cows. I've got my 6 white cows that I carry around for this specific purpose, and I've got a patch of green grass over maybe at the football field. There might still be a little if it's not turf, and we will get them to eat some green grass. And so sure enough, we do. They're eating that green grass. We go after the class, and you see them eating that green grass. After the service, I take everybody out there. They got purple spots the size of tennis balls on them. All over them. There's purple spots everywhere. And I say, see, proved it. And you say, well, that is, I mean, that is interesting. So one of you who is pretty accustomed to dealing with cows, you go up and you start looking at the cow and you pet the cow. And then your forehead's itching a little bit. And you rub your forehead and you come back in to lunch and your wife looks up at your forehead and she says, you got purple all over your head. You say, what? She said, you got purple all over your hand. So sure enough, you got purple on your hand. You go in the bathroom, there's purple all over your head. You wipe it off, and you think, where'd I get that? And then you go to that one cow that you were petting, and the dot is smudged. And you come to me, and you say, Kyle, you said you had this theory that when white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. That's false. You painted these spots on these cows. And I said, yeah, I did. But the advantage of this example is it's extremely visual. Yeah. I mean, it's not right, but you can see it real well. Man, those purple spots, they just really stick out. They just... He says, well, we know it's wrong, but you can see it so well. Now, here's what I guess aggravates me the worst. We want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, the high school students, they can look at it more critically. When is later on? You ever seen a class that says all the stuff we told you that proved evolution that doesn't really... reevaluated, 101. You ever seen a college course that says critically analyzing the evidence that we said proved evolution but doesn't? When is later on in this situation? You know, as I was studying this, there was a man who was really aggravated about this information. He had a PhD, a terminal degree in one of the sciences, and he said that in all the course of his entire instruction, he had never been encouraged to or seen a critical evaluation of the English peppered moths, and at no time from the time he was in elementary school to when he got a terminal PhD was he ever allowed to, encouraged to, or given the opportunity to critically analyze the English peppered moth scenario. I think it's interesting that that word, later on they can look at it more critically, but not now. Because what we want to do, according to these evolutionists teaching these young men, we want to teach them this and get them to believe it and buy it And later it will be too late because they've already bought into it. You see the problem there. This is Ernst Haeckel. Ernst Haeckel in 1860, the year after Charles Darwin's Origin of Species by Natural Selection was printed, it was translated into German. Haeckel read it and said, "This is the greatest thing I've ever seen. This proves it. This nails it. This is it. And he said, "I'm going to come up with evidence for it." And so he started studying and he came up with the law of embryology. And the law of embryology said ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Let that sink in. Doesn't it just sound so smart? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. I mean, I really feel smarter just being able to say that. And a lot of you are thinking, what in the world? Well, I would not have known what ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny was either until I began to study this material. Here's what he said. Ontogeny, an organism's growth from embryo up, recaps, goes through its phylogeny, its evolutionary history. And so what he said was, if you were looking at the embryo of a human and you zoomed in at the right time, after conception, you'd see it in a fish stage. And then you wait a little while and zoom in a little bit later, you'll see it in a reptile stage. Wait a little while, zoom in a little bit later, you'll see it in a lower mammal stage. Wait a little while, a little bit later, you'll see it in a different stage. And he says you'll see it in all these different stages. And it's recapitulating, it's recapping its evolutionary history. And they said, well, you got any evidence of that? He said, yeah, I got all kinds of evidence for it. Look, check these pictures out. Notice that all of these, this human, dog, pig, etc., turtle, salamander, well, chicken, they all have a fish stage. And they start with gill slits, and then they move on up, etc. And he said, this proves it. This is the law of embryology. Named it a law in 1860. Well, the professors with Dr. Haeckel said, that doesn't really look like the pictures of real embryos we deal with. You know, that salamander and that salamander and that fish are quite a bit different looking, and that's not what your pictures show. Where'd you get your pictures? He said, oh, I made some of them up. Just drew them from memory. And if I understand it right, said, sometimes I'd take one embryo and I'd draw it three different times and I'd label it three different things. I'd take a dog embryo, I'd draw that same dog embryo three times, I'd label a dog, a pig, and human. They said, So you just made this stuff up? And he said, yeah, but it still proves the point that humans evolved from lower primates. Had somebody contact me the other day. I say the other day, actually this was a little while back. And he said, you guys are idiots. Everything on your website you need to remove. You are lying to people and you need to admit it. And you need to step into the 21st century scientific world. And get that all the time. We always do. And so I responded and said, hey, I understand what you're saying. I would respectfully disagree with it. And could you show me any specific teaching on our website that you feel like is incorrect? And he wrote back and he said, well, it's just all so wrong, I wouldn't even know where to start. I said, okay. I said, then could you give me the single most powerful piece of evidence that you have that proves humans evolved? The most powerful you got. He wrote back and said, yes, I could. He said, the fact that humans have gill slits when they are early in their conception, after they've been conceived early in their embryological development, proves that they came from fish and lower animals. I said, okay. That's a soothing ringtone, isn't it? It's almost like you just want to take a nap, like some of you have, sitting there. All right, where were we? Yes, out of my reverie. All right, he said, yeah, they all got gill slits. From after a point of conception, as they're developing, they got gill slits. This proves that humans evolved from lower mammals. I said, okay, let me send you, if you don't mind, the information from Stephen Jay Gould, where he wrote, atrocious, Haeckel's distortions did not help Darwin, where it says, Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago. Now, here's what I want you to catch. Hold on. But that popular culture has never fully abandoned, If only because the standard description sounds so wonderfully arcane and mellifluous, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, otherwise known as the theory of recapitulation or the claim that organisms retrace their evolutionary history. Now here's what he says. He says, science disproved this. But you wouldn't know it because the textbooks have kept it in their writings. And then he says, notice, we should not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings enter 19th century textbooks. He said, all right, everybody makes mistakes. You put the wrong stuff in there sometimes. This just happens. But we should be, I think, both astonished and ashamed by the century of mindless recycling that's led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not majority, of modern textbooks. That's okay. Look, that I had a preacher that was sitting on the front row. I was delivering my lesson. It was a Wednesday night lesson. He was sitting on the front row, and boy, he was listening. He was watching, and all of a sudden, his iPad starts talking very, very loudly. Well, it starts reading a paragraph that he had gotten, I think, off of the internet, in this loud reading voice. And so, of course, he's embarrassed, and he's trying to turn it off, and he can't turn it off. He doesn't know how to turn it off. And so it goes, and I know the guy. I knew him from college, and I'm like, Kerry, come on. And so he cannot get it off. It just keeps going. So finally he has to pass it back to his wife on the next row, and she finally gets it off, and we move forward from there. But that happens all the time. All right, so here's what you got. I send this guy Stephen Jay Gould's statement about Haeckel's embryos being absolutely false. Now, the fact of the matter is, I would not be still talking about Haeckel's embryos if they took them out of textbooks. I've been talking about Haeckel's embryos for 18 years and am going to continue to talk about Haeckel's embryos till they take them out of the textbook. I was up in Michigan, and there was a freshman in high school. She came to our seminar. 2 weeks later, she wrote me. She said, you were just at my congregation talking about Haeckel's embryos and English peppered moths. She said, I found it very interesting. And then 2 weeks later in my biology class, they used those two examples to prove evolution. She said, I thought it was humorous, and I was prepared for that, and I appreciate you coming so we could be prepared to deal with that. Okay, that's real exciting, except for the fact that they're still using this stuff in the textbooks, and the reason they're still allowed to use this stuff in the textbooks is because you're not encouraged to look at the stuff critically. In fact, you're supposed to just don't talk, don't answer, don't question. Let us dump this into your mind. Later, when you are close to death, you can maybe reconsider it somehow, but we're not going to give you a class on it for sure. And that's why Stephen Jay Gould can say a century of mindless recycling. Mindless recycling. That's what has occurred. Maybe you've seen this, horse evolution. There's a shrine to horse evolution, I call it a shrine, at the Washington, D.C. Smithsonian Institute. If you were to go there, you would see that huge elephant right there. I don't know, how many of you guys have been to the Smithsonian there in Washington, D.C.? Okay, you remember that big elephant, that big entrance there? I was asking some of the workers how many kids come into the Smithsonian every day. 10,000 kids. It's free. Free. I mean, you pay your taxes and the government takes your taxes and builds the Smithsonian and then lets all the kids come in free. It is free. But in there, there's this shrine to horse evolution. You walk into it. It's like this little tunnel. And you see all of these little fossils. I'm going to say the thing costs $500,000. And these beautiful pictures that were done by these amazing artists. And you go through and you see this little creature, Hyracotherium eohippus, meaning what, dawn horse, early horse. And he supposedly evolved all the way up into modern horse. And this is an example of evolution taking place. This has been in textbooks, and it's in the Smithsonian, and it's been all over the place for the last 60 years. Well, as you start looking at that, George Gather Simpson, one of the leading evolutionists in the world, says, the uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium into Equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. You mean to tell me it's been in the textbooks for 60 years? There's a shrine to this alleged horse evolution in the Smithsonian. It presents all the exact same stuff that supposedly happened in nature, and yet it never happened in nature. It only happened where? In the textbooks. How can this happen? How do we keep running into the fact that this stuff has been disproven for years? I put this statement in there intentionally. How long have we known this to be the case? This is since 1953. I was at the Smithsonian in 2000, and I don't know, I think it was 2010 or so. I'm assuming that shrine is still there. I haven't been in the last 10 years or so. But in 2010 it was there, which was 60 years later, and we've known this is not the case. And so what's happening? Well, mindless recycling. This idea of homology, we don't have time to touch on it much, but here's what we're told. If things look similar, then they're obviously related. And so as you start looking at the human wrist, the cat leg wrist, the whale wrist, the bat wrist, what you see is a similar structure of bones. And so the fact that they are similar proves they are related, and this is a piece of evidence to prove evolution. Here's what you need to understand about some of this information. Some of this information, it's not the facts that we're arguing with, it's the interpretation on the facts that we're arguing with. Now, some of the times, it's the facts that we're arguing with. English Pepper Moth, that's where you got some challenges with it. Those weren't real facts. Haeckel's embryos, those weren't real facts. Now this, okay, are there similarities between the structures of the whale bones and the human wrist? Are there similarities? Yeah. Well, so does that mean humans evolved from whales or vice versa, or they're related somewhere down the evolutionary line? No. Now, one interpretation would be, hey, similarity always means relation. Does similarity always mean relation? Not always. In fact, you could have some things that are very similar that wouldn't be related at all due to certain constraints on things. Let me ask you a question. Generally speaking, now, not all the time, but generally speaking, how many legs does a table have? You mean to tell me that some Amish people in Etheridge, Tennessee, who build a table, they're going to build it with four legs, and the tables down here that are going to be built anywhere down here in Texas are going to be built with four legs? That's because those tables are related. You got similarity. That's because the people who are building them somehow, no, okay, why would you build a table with four legs? Well, there's a pretty good reason why you would build a table with four legs. You can get away with a three-legged table, and sometimes they've done those on some of those Eagle Claw old antique tables you've seen. But most tables have four legs because that's the best structure for being able to hold pretty heavy weight and it still hold up and be able to put several people around it. It's a good structure. It's a good function. And so it's not that, how many, well, we got all kinds of cars out. Generally speaking, what are the materials for the tires made out of on your cars? Rubber. That's because all those cars are related? No, it's because you're driving over the same roads. Now think about this. If you had a creator that was going to create organisms that were going to move across the same type of landscapes, eat the same kinds of food, breathe the same kinds of air, drink the same kinds of water, need to digest it, etc., would you suggest that there would be some similarities between those structures because you have a common designer, not a common ancestry? Well, yeah, absolutely. And so the evolutionist looks at this and says, well, you've got common structures. And we say, yeah, sure you do. And they say, that proves that they evolved from each other. No, it doesn't. It could just as easily, in fact, more so, prove that they had a common designer. And so when those interpretations are placed on the facts, you need to question some of those and say, hold on just a second. You're saying that all homologous structures, all structures that are similar, that proves some type of evolutionary relationship, but it doesn't. I can show you several things that have similarities that aren't related. They have a common designer. And so you question those false interpretations. Now let me end this particular lesson with the story about a man who right now is a project manager at NASA for the rocket science division. This guy literally is a rocket scientist. He grew up as an atheist. In fact, that's what was taught in his house. He wasn't a hard-nosed atheist insofar as that was just his worldview. That's what his parents had taught him. That's what he had always been shown this idea of evolution he always took to be true. He just thought humans evolved over multiplied millions of years from lower primates, etc. He never did look at the work critically with an open mind. He never studied it carefully. He just always assumed it was true. And then one day something clicked. He had gotten a PhD from MIT in aeronautic engineering. And along the way, he started to ask himself, you know, I've always been taught that this evolution stuff is proven. I'm not sure that's the case. And so he started looking at it more closely and critically considering it and analyzing the millions or billions of year old ideas and realized, well, hold on just a second. They don't have evidence for this. And what I was told proved this doesn't. And when he started critically considering it and studying it carefully with an open mind, he quickly rejected it and realized that, no, this stuff is not right. This is not real science. And then, not only did he do that, but he started asking himself, well, what is real science? And so he started looking into the creation question, and he became a creationist. And not only that, then he started reading his Bible and studied himself into the Lord's church. And has been a faithful Christian for the last several decades, and now is a staff writer for us at Apologetics Press. His name is Dr. Mike Houts. And he goes around with me on a number of occasions to the college campuses. And he deals with the technical stuff that I give the popular answer to. We had a question about the dating methods and the millions of years that we might get to get into just a minute here in the next session after break. And I gave the illustrations for, hey, this is how the layman understands it. But Dr. Houts, would you explain it? And you know, there are some people that talk in big words to impress people. And then there are some people that talk with big words because you can tell that's how they think in their mind. Well, Dr. Houts is one of those people that that's just how he thinks. He just processes it. He is genuinely just brilliant. And the atheistic student organization had come. They were sitting about right where you guys were. And one of them raised their hand and said, well, how do you explain this about the dating methods? And Dr. Houts went into the explanation about the radiometric dating and the parent element and the daughter element and the uranium-238B, etc. And at the end of it, the young man who asked the question said, oh, appreciate it, thanks. And that was it. Because Dr. Houts had studied it through with an open mind and carefully looked at it and critically considered it, and he had come to a rational, reasonable answer about these kinds of information. Now, here's what I would suggest to you. If you are challenged by this information, one way or the other, don't stop where you are. You study Christianity with an open mind. You study evolution critically considering it. You study it very, very carefully, and you tell yourself, I am going to follow the evidence where it leads. And I believe if you do that, and you're honest to that mode of operation, that you will arrive at being a New Testament Christian. You guys have listened so well. We're going to take another 10-minute break. Then we're going to come back in for the final 25 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for question and answers, and then we will feel free to eat some more sandwiches and cookies. All right, you got a break?